Welcome everybody to the Ontolog panel session on the URL Units of Measure Ontology Standard, getting ready for the OASIS CHROMOS TC transition, and the date here is the 7th of January 2010. Now, if we look back to last March and April when the Ontology Forum had its summit meeting looking at how ontologists could help standardizers and vice versa, this area of units of measure was seen to be one of the areas which was a useful pilot where ontology technologies could be used to bring together a range of different units of measure and quantities activities that have already been standardized, but to be able to deliver them in a usable form for some of the reasoning engines that are out there. So what we're really looking at is how to encapsulate and validate the information models that are out there. If you scroll down the panel session, you will find there's a large amount of reference material that's already there. We've tied in, hopefully, to all the existing standardization activities, and we've pulled together the charter for an OASIS technical committee to take on the standardization work. So it's a transition out from the, if you like, the incubator of the Ontology Forum into a formal standards activity to develop the ontology. Now, we've been going through the process of setting up an OASIS technical committee, and if you open up the slides for my presentation, you should find the first slide, which is starting the OASIS CHROMOS TC. For those who haven't been involved in the process, we looked at a variety of standard development organizations and deliberated that OASIS would probably be the best organization to act as the basis for this activity. If we have the requirements to have a publicly available ontology free of charge, which can be used on the web. Now, what we've done is moved through the whole process, and I'm just hesitating because for some reason my slides are not coming up on my machine. If you move to the second slide, before Christmas, back in November, we set ourselves a number of deadlines to achieve the technical committee. We achieved those milestones with no contingency. In fact, we could have held this, we could have launched the meeting a week earlier than we planned to do so. We put out the TC charter to OASIS, and that went round for discussion within the OASIS community. And then in December, that comment period closed. The only comments were support from NIST and some refinements from PETA. So that was a very easy job to put together the final TC charter, which was posted to the OASIS lists and distributed beyond that on the 14th of December. So what we have is the final version of the charter, the call for the first meeting, which will be held on the 21st of January. Now, under OASIS rules, if you want to be a voting member at that first meeting, then you need to have to be eligible under OASIS terms, and I'll come to that on the next slide. Also on that deadline, OASIS will put out a call for nominations for the chair of the technical committee. Okay, all this is perfectly standard OASIS procedure. You choose any standard organization and you will find an appropriate mechanism. Right. In order to do the kickoff for the meeting, if you move to slide 3, we've pulled together a draft agenda for that first meeting. Inevitably, we must start with a roll call to determine who is eligible to be in the TC on the call, and then we go to the first formal order of business, which is to elect a chair from the voting members present at the meeting. Those are, and you'll see the definition of voting members in a minute. of the numbering has become corrupted on this, but never mind. I'll be convening the first meeting. After the new chair is elected, I'll be handing over control to them for the rest of it. But we will take the opportunity, hopefully with Jamie Clark, president from Oasis, to highlight the various things we need to know as an UTC about the Oasis process, the IPR policy that we've selected, and the public relations that are put in place. There'll be an opportunity to briefly review the charter, provide any clarifications that are raised, and look at how we're going to work as a committee. And then there will be a simple vote, hopefully, on any standing rules that we want to set up for the meeting. Basically, the usual ones are here to say that we can work electronically and doing ballots rather than working at meetings. And I think there's an issue which we need to discuss over whether the sessions are recorded, as this one is being recorded. So all very much administrative stuff for the first part of the agenda. If you go to the slide 4, we'll also be looking at making sure we have enough of the relevant people to operate the committee, basically useful to have a secretary, a webmaster, and individuals who will act as liaisons to the individual committees that we need to talk to, obviously. That's the ISO groups, all the various people who've developed ontologies, and so on, the CNL guys as well. And that will lead us on then to looking at the contributed work and bringing that in to the committee, confirming the work program, any requirements for the website, and the ongoing meeting schedule, because all that can be set by the TC at the first meeting. I'm not anticipating a huge amount of technical work being done at the time, but it will kick us off into a regular drumbeat of activities. Looking at the last slide, what do we need to do now to make it happen? Actually, it's all down largely to the people who really want to participate. If you want to be there on the 21st, you need to be an employee of an Oasis member or an individual member. If there are problems with that, talk to Scott McGrath at Oasis, who's the membership secretary. You then need to set up and request from Oasis an account, which will allow you to access the Oasis website. Once you've got that, you go to the technical committee page, click on a button, and ask to join the TC. You may also choose to be a voting member or just a participating member. The reason for not having too many voting members is because that's how you define the quorum of a meeting. And if everybody is a voting member, then sometimes you can't vote because there are too many members not there. The thing that takes time is that once you have requested the participation in the group, you need to get the approval of your organization's primary Oasis rep. That's as simple for them as clicking yes in an email, but sometimes that takes time. If you are the primary rep, it's easy. If you're an individual rep, it's easy because you don't have to have that approval. Then you need to do that if you're there at the meeting in any way, shape, or form. If you're going to be a voting member, you need to have done this by 1 week from today, the 14th of January. And obviously, to vote at the first meeting, you actually need to be there. Now, the challenge is to ensure that we have 5 eligible members that are already Oasis members, and 2 of those at least must be from organisational members. That should at least include myself and Jerry Smith, so that part of the requirement is handled. But we need to make sure that there are at least five members present, otherwise the meeting will be deemed to have failed and we've got to start again. So, that's where we are in setting up the TC. That's the process we've got to go through. I'll open that up for any questions. You will need to press star 3 to unmute yourself. Or fire any questions up on the chat room if they are...
I actually have a question. Feel free to refuse to answer it, but how long would we take before people in Oasis would think we were taking too long? I mean, what's the sort of typical time span of these sort of processes, or is there no such typical?
They'll start looking after a year if nothing's happened at all. I'm in a slightly embarrassing situation that we did a committee specification ballot on a committee draft ballot on a standard in another Oasis technical committee, and actually we're just coming up on 2 years. So it depends really whether work is taking place or not. So it's not like the nasty ISO, you have three time frames and you must adopt one of them, and if you don't stick to the time frame, your project will be cancelled. It's much more free than that.
Well, the other problem, obviously, I should think, is that depending on how much work one takes on and how much of that has to be interconnected in the appropriate ways, the project can be longer or shorter. Sorry, Ted. What I was thinking is that you said there might not be much technical work. I think the one area where there might be technical work among the, quote, administrative activities here is the discussion and acceptance of contributed work. We believe that we know what we're going to do in that line, but obviously that will be open for debate of the PC at the time that it actually shows up.
I'm only highlighting that we might not get too much technical work done at the first meeting. But I think the charter is indicating that we're looking to proceed on a fortnightly telecon. So after the administrative of the first meeting is out of the way, I would anticipate seeing a lot of technical work going on with the basic content.
Well, and in fact, we've seen that the technical work is going on without the existence of the TC thus far. So that's good. The other piece that I was going to ask is one thing that is not clear in the list of appointment of officers is how is the editing of the standard done? I mean, this is something I don't know about Oasis, but it is conventional in almost every other organization to appoint an editor for the standard rather than a webmaster whose job I should think would be to maintain things like the wikis. Which is a different matter from maintaining. I mean, unless the webmaster actually ends up W3C behavior maintaining the HTML elements of the document as it evolves.
The lists I've put down are examples. If you don't want to nominate somebody formally, that's fine. There's nothing in the rules to prevent it.
Okay. Well, the point is that we need to make clear what these jobs are when we construct it. I mean, I assume that to some extent we have some of these jobs are appointed, are sort of required of the TC by Oasis that need to have somebody who's the contact for this, the contact for that, and the contact for the other. But at the other end of that, I assume that we also have a choice of how we organize the technical responsibilities, and ultimately there will effectively be sort of pseudo officers who have certain technical responsibilities. Is that... Peter has thought about this before. So.
He's to sort out... For example, in PLCS, we don't have a single editor. We have multiple editors for multiple components of the standard.
Yeah, that's sort of what
I think. So, organize it to suit.
Okay.
Any other questions? I do emphasize that while certain elements of the Oasis rules are relatively free and easy, the participation ones tend to be rather tight, so we will have to make sure that we have people up and running on the. We make sure we have at least five members. I think I've got four highlighted already, but we need to make sure that there are enough to get us started. Okay, I think that's
Howard.
If there are no other questions, I think that's the ghastly administrator out of the way. That will should give us in 2 weeks' time a clean launch of the technical committee, and the activity there will plow on and as decided at that first meeting. Right. So I'm a great delight in handing over to Chuck to give a personal perspective on the VIM and other aspects of all the existing standards that are put in place for metrology. Chuck, over to you. Start break.
Okay, well, thank you, Howard. I'll begin as I did on Monday with a disclaimer. I do need to say that I'm providing my own comments and perspective here, not that of NIST or any organization that I mention, and nothing that I say should be construed to represent NIST policy or that of any other organization. So that's my disclaimer, and I'll also thank Steve Ray for inviting me to do this, and I hope that I can meet the expectations here. Steve's asked me basically to give an overview, as you just said, Howard, of the extensive metrology and measurement infrastructure that already exists, that's been thought about and dealt with over the years. I'll give you some historical background on these things that have been thought about, the terminology and related issues that your group is dealing with. And then to point you to some references that you might find useful. So I see that as my mission. I'll do my best and rely on Steve and all of you to redirect me if I'm not going in a direction that's useful to you. As someone just said, no one wants to go down well-traveled rabbit holes, so hopefully I'll help give some references that'll help in that regard. Okay, you're all undoubtedly familiar with the International System of Units, or the SI, but you might not be so familiar with how it came to be or the organization that has overall responsibility for maintaining it, which is the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, or BIPM, which is headquartered just outside of Paris. And it has a website, BIPM.org, and I encourage those of you who have never been to that website to go there and look it over and download what's called the SI brochure, and especially the concise four-page summary. And you can get to that by using the search engine on the home page of the BIPM website and then just type in SI brochure. There's a committee of the BIPM called the Consultative Committee on Units, or CCU, that has responsibility for proposing changes to the SI to a body called the General Conference on Weights and Measures, or CGPM, which is the primary oversight and decision-making body of the BIPM. And the membership of the CGPM, the CCU, all of the BIPM consultative committees comes from the member countries of the treaty that established the BIPM in 1875. So the CCU oversees the definitions of the SI units, including the base and derived units, and it also oversees what are called mise en pratique, which are the practical methods for physically realizing the definitions of the units. Many countries have what are called National Metrology Institutes, or NMIs, that carry out these mise en pratique for at least the base SI units, and frequently for other SI and non-SI units, so that the units can be traceably disseminated in their countries. NIST is the NMI that sits at the top of the traceability chain for measurement dissemination in the U.S. So NIST performs calibrations of instruments and systems to facilitate measurement dissemination to numerous calibration laboratories in the industry, government, academia, et cetera. Basically, anyone who needs traceability for measurements, and there's a chain. NIST doesn't
obviously calibrate things for everyone, but they calibrate things for higher level labs to then disseminate down the chain. In the past, the BIPM actually carried out the mise en pratique and calibrations for other countries, but this is not the way that it's really done much very now, except in the area of mass. The BIPM still maintains the international kilogram, although that could actually change in a few years, but at least for now they have that. But while they do carry out such calibrations for some countries, now many countries have their own primary standards and conduct intercomparisons among themselves that frequently the BIPM coordinates through its consultative committees. So that's all I really wanted to say now about the physical aspect of measurement, unless there are any questions, so that I can address more of what I believe you're interested in, which is the metrology infrastructure pertaining to terminology and more theoretical aspects of measurement, and in particular to what underpins the International Vocabulary of Metrology, or VIM, that I believe that many of you at least know about. So let me stop for a moment and see, are there any questions concerning the physical aspects here of measurement?
Chuck and Todd, I think that's a very key point, that you've got the theoretical definitions and also the area related to the actual, if you like, methods for realization of those definitions. You seem to be saying two separate aspects.
Yes. Well, what I've discussed so far is to give an idea of how the physical aspect of measurement gets organized and conducted internationally. I mean, there's more I could say about that, but what I thought would be more useful is to now go into the terminology considerations.
That's
so
right.
Does that sound okay?
Sounds good to me, and nobody else is screaming.
Okay, very good. Okay, so the modern, I'll say modern story here for the terminology end of things also begins with the BIPM, although historically there is a very large literature concerning the theory of measurement. And much of that predates the BIPM. There is an article in the journal Metrologia, which is the scientific publication of the BIPM, that I wanted to point out to you if you're not already familiar with it, titled On the History of Quantity Calculus and the International System. And it was written by De Boer in 1994. And it's... this article lays the groundwork for the modern usage of quantity calculus and discusses the relationship among quantities, units, equations, dimensions, and the like. It's volume 31 of the 94-95 issue of Metrologia, pages 405 to 429. And I think if there are those of you not familiar with that, that would be a good article to read as something that underpins, what I feel underpins the current metrology infrastructure. This quantity calculus formalism has been further developed in ISO publications, first in ISO 31, which was published in 1992, and then very recently in the ISO 80,000 series of publications. So I'd like to strongly encourage you to take a look at those two. If you're not familiar with them, you will have to buy the ISO publications, I suppose. Returning to the VIM and to where it comes from, the first edition was developed under the leadership of the BIPM director, but it was published by ISO in 1984. And the situation was pretty much the same for the second edition, which was published in 1993. And then development of the third edition started in that same direction, but in 1993 another document was also published that I will assume that you're all familiar with, called the Guide to the Expression of Uncertainty in Measurement, or GUM. And at that point, things changed concerning the development of these documents. In early 1997, a new organization was established called the Joint Committee for Guides in Metrology, or JCGM, and it has two working groups, one that oversees maintenance and revision of the GUM, and then the second one to oversee maintenance and revision of the VIM. And the JCGM was developed in recognition that there are several international organizations that are interested in and could benefit from having an internationally harmonized and recognized metrology vocabulary, as well as a uniform approach to measurement uncertainty. And it would be beneficial to have those organizations work together in developing and overseeing the appropriate documents. There were seven initial members of the JCGM, the BIPM, OIML, which is the International Organization of Legal Metrology, ISO and IEC, IUPAC, the International Union of Pure and Applied Physics, IUPAC, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, and then the ISCC, which is the International Federation of Clinical Chemists. And then in 2005, ILAC joined the JCGM, which is the International Laboratory Accreditation, I think, Cooperation. And you can find more about the JCGM, including its members and its charter, on the BIPM website. If you go to the website, click on the English version on committees at the top, and then you'll see JCGM listed as one of them. The way this works is the eight organizations provide representation on these two working groups that I mentioned. They're allowed up to three members each. And so the development process for the VIM now and the GOM is to go through a very ISO-like commenting and voting process. So it's a formal process and that you're all used to. The development of the VIM 3, which I did take part in, and in fact, I guess I should have given a little background at the beginning. I saw that somebody put together a biography for me on your site, so you've seen that. I'll just add that I'm now the chairman of the VIM, the working group two of the VIM committee, and I participated in the development of the VIM 3. The way that it was developed, it's based heavily on the principles that are expressed in ISO standards on terminology. So those are relied on heavily. There are three I wanted to point out, ISO 704, ISO 1087-1, and ISO 10241, which is currently under revision. So those are the principles used, if anyone wants to go and look at those. And a lot of the discussion in the development of the VIM 3 includes many of the things that you all have been talking about. I won't claim at all that I've looked at very much of what you all have written, but I have seen a little bit. And of what I've seen, it's not clear that there's a good one-to-one correspondence between some of your stuff and the VIM 3 terminology. And so I guess I would like to encourage you, for sake of harmonization, to give it a closer look and see what you might want to adopt. And I suppose that's pretty much Steve's interest in having me make this presentation was to try to help facilitate that. I'm not sure right now how much time I'll be able to give to this effort, but we'll just see what happens down the line. But we'll try to figure out some way of harmonizing things if you all are interested in doing that. I'll add that each of the organizations that I mentioned, the eight of them, are still allowed, I'll say, under the JCGM charter to have their own specialty vocabularies. And I don't mean to imply by what I'm saying that I think that you just need to accept what's in the VIM 3 lock, stock, and barrel. But in the interest of harmonization, it would probably be best to do that to the extent possible. And then we do realize that in each specialty metrology area, there will be terms, concepts that are specific to those, and so a specialty vocabulary is appropriate with the idea that the VIM will have those terms and concepts that are of a more general nature in metrology. So that's my canned speech here, and so I guess I'll stop and kind of open up to questions or comments or whatever.
Thanks very much, Doug. That's very helpful, and I think the guidance on the use of VIM 3 terminology would be quite helpful, because it would prevent us having to invent something that people won't recognize. One of the challenges of all this ontology development is to ensure that we have unambiguous definitions around the place. So, any questions for Chuck? We'll need to unmute.
Yes, I have a question. Are there slides that have some of the citations that Chuck mentioned?
If you could provide Peter with the URLs to a number of these sites, I'm sure we will add them to our resource list.
I can do that. Yeah, I didn't prepare slides on, and as I said at the beginning, it's still a little tenuous as far as the how to take part in this for me and for NIST. So, but yeah, I see no problem in sending an email with the citations.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I think I'm seeing Steve's hand up. Steve, right?
Yes, I just wanted to say that I want to appreciate Chuck on the record here. That I know this is. Take a lot of clearance and stuff in this, but I really appreciate you giving us that kind of a detailed pointer to a lot of good references. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Steve, and thanks for the invitation, and do what I can here, and then hopefully things can get harmonized.
Okay, thank you, Pat.
I was just wondering. I was trying to get hold of this 1994 paper while we were speaking, and with every copy of it costs at least there's not even money. So my question really is, how important is it to have an awareness of history, or can we take the BIM 3 as kind of a product that we can simply take with that as a self-contained entity?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. It's an interesting question. We try to be as consistent, as possible, and consistent with the historical aspects in the VIM 3 as we could. I think that there are still some issues, however, having to do with things like dimension and of a quantity and things that are discussed in that paper. That quantity calculus, but I mentioned that even though the VIM covers these things and has definitions for them, I'd say they're still open topics in a sense. You'll see in that paper that DeBoer says that while we still maybe don't understand exactly what we mean when we multiply lengths by times or divide one unit by another, it works when you put it into the quantity calculus, and so away we go. But that's not to say that it's all totally well understood from a philosophical point of view. So I guess that's the best answer I can give. I think that it still would be a good idea to look at some of this history, but the VIM 3 tries to bring it together into a coherent whole. To a large extent.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Pat. And, Reese Berg has his hand up. You need to feel free to unmute. Hiyo, you there?
Hi.
You need to press
Hi.
3 to unmute.
Yes.
Okay, you're there.
Can you hear me?
You're there.
Hi. Oh, yeah, thank you. My question is, to your opinion, to what extent should the ontology follow him, or may it deviate a little from him?
Are you, is that a question?
Yes.
Yes, okay. That's a hard thing to say. I mean, it's impossible. It would be good to harmonize with them just so that we have, internationally, that we have one term, one concept, a one term, one concept relationship. I mean, the difficulty, something we struggled with in developing the VIM-3 was doing that. We ultimately were able to do it, but there were points where it wasn't clear we'd be able to because of common usages of terms associated with multiple concepts. Our feeling is that ideally there would be one term, one concept, and so for that reason, I think it would be good to harmonize. If there's an obvious reason that can't happen, then you have to deal with it. And, there's no, unless there's some regulatory issue involved in some country or something as far as what units are used. I mean, in most countries, there are legal units of measure, which can dictate what's used, and possibly even legal qualifications on what terms are used. But as far as the JCGM goes, it's really, it's not a legal matter, and whatever organization uses different terms for whatever reasons, and there's nothing the JCGM is going to do about it. But it just causes difficulties.
Well, okay, thanks.
I don't know if that's helpful, but that's sort of, I guess, the way I would treat it.
It sounds to me as though you've run into the normal issue of standardization where there's established stuff out there which we'll obviously need to reflect into the ontology as we endeavor to eliminate ambiguity. But we obviously need to link back and identify where those common usages may well have corrupted the definitions or compromises have had to be made. Thank you. Next one up, Ed Bartmeyer. R3?
Hi, yeah. I think the problem here is not so much in inventing new terms. The concern here is about formalizing definitions. And I think that's really where the rubber is going to meet the road. I mean, you're not going to get formal logic to have the English language that's in the VIM. You can get it, you hope, to say exactly the same thing where it's clear exactly what the same thing is. And that, I guess, is really underlying, is the underlying concern that I think is where the question of, quote, the deviation really enters in. I mean, there's no reason for us to invent terminology that is different from the terminology of the VIM other than perhaps to put, underscores in it or whatever. But the real issue here is the extent to which one can formally maintain exactly the sense of the English definition.
Okay, thanks for that. I think that's a good clarification rather than the question, and that takes us on to Hans Peter.
Hello, yes, Hans Peter. My question is, in ISO 31 and some other places, the quantities that are defined are specifically mentioned to be physical quantities. In the VIM, it's just called quantity. Is that deliberate? Is it meant to be now or later on including, let's say, quantities that are not per se physical quantities?
Well, the VIM-3 definition is a property of a phenomenon, body, or substance. So,
right.
I guess you could say say that phenomenon bodies or substances, bodies or substances are physical things. I guess a phenomenon is a physical thing, but it was really intended to be a high level definition, a general definition.
Right.
It's not of a particular quantity. Talk about particular quantities, and the table there in 1.1 of the Vim Cree kind of shows that progression.
Right. Well, the reason I'm asking is because you have many, let's say, numerical quantities or numerical properties in modeling systems that are not necessarily physical quantities. Like, you could use the same model for quantifying cost expressed in different kinds of valuta or things like that. And also, for instance, quantify priority or more virtual concepts rather than physical properties.
I'm not sure exactly how to respond to that.
I think we're getting into the level of technical detail here, which is actually very indicative of the need to have people like Chuck available to the group to clarify specific questions as we develop the ontology.
Yeah, and that's fine. As I told Steve, we're in a phase now with the Vim committee of basically collecting feedback on the Vim 3, towards thinking, very long term about where we go next. And so that's part of my interest in taking part in this and doing this was to get that kind of feedback from you all. I'm certainly open to listening to this to the extent that I can, and to look in the chat. And I will mention this activity. I already have actually to the Vim committee, and so we'll see what level of interest the members have in looking at the things that you've written and using that as input to the discussion.
That would be great, because that's a perfect example of ontologists and standardizers interacting to hopefully make both products better. That's great. Steve?
Thanks. Two quick questions, Chuck. One was to follow up on Ed's point about the multiple languages. I was curious how the Vim 3 committee is represented in terms of things that are perhaps not always in English. So that was my first quick question. My second question was your last point. When is the deadline to get feedback to the Vim 3 committee?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good point, Jim. In fact, I almost said something, too, when Ed had said that about the languages. Yeah, language is certainly an issue that the Vim 3 committee dealt with because it's a bilingual document, the Vim 3, and in fact, there are many countries translating it. So it's into other languages, but I think the issue is really more fundamental, though. We finally had to trying to think how to say this best. I mean, because in different languages, concepts are developed differently, they're expressed differently. Some people on the committee had difficulty with some of the definitions, and I'll give as an example in the first entry, quantity is the term magnitude. There are some languages where it's not easy to translate magnitude cleanly, and so we finally addressed this by saying, well, we're doing this in English, and so we really have to develop consistency in English, and then hopefully these things can be translated appropriately. But I know even going English to French, sometimes it's not an exact translation. It just couldn't be. So it's an issue. It is an issue. There are a large number of languages represented on the committee, although we work in English. and this is an important issue. And for instance, it was pointed out in the Slavic languages that they don't use articles, or at least not the same way. So the distinction between me and a isn't there, which sometimes is a very important distinction to make in a definition. So we tried to be sensitive to all those things, but it's not easy. To your second question about the timetable, the BIM committee will next be meeting in late May, but as far as a deadline goes, you have this explicit feedback that you'd like to provide. If you could get it to me by say the end of April, that would be good, but that would just be for discussion at the next meeting. But I think we'll be discussing this feedback actually for some time, so there's not a huge urgency. But if you do, I would say at least a first deadline would be the end of April.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. We've got two more on this one, then I will plow on with the next part of the agenda, which addresses a number of the scope issues that have, including those hopefully that have been raised in the chat room. Pat, star three.
Sorry, that was star three. Can I return a little to the question that we came up with a little while ago, and Ed put his finger exactly on the point about vocabulary. The major issue for us, I think, is not so much can we not follow, say, the vocabulary. We obviously can and should as far as possible. It's if the VIN defines some very high level concept like quantity, in a way that seems to us to be too descriptive, so rather general, what should we do, right? Should we just say, well, okay, we'll stick to the VIM's definition? Or should we introduce a different concept, quantity prime or something, and explicitly say ours is more general than the VIM quantity? In other words, should we try and adapt ourselves to the VIM, or should we absorb the VIM and make it explicitly a special case? The problem with the second route is that it leads to this sort of cluster of subtly different, slightly philosophically different concepts at the top, which confuses everybody, including what would be the right authorities. Any feedback or comments on that? What the issue would be great.
I think that's a good point, if we need to extend, then that's perhaps the sort of feedback I would suggest that the VIN committee might be looking for.
Yeah, it is, in fact, and I'll say that, in fact, that is some feedback we've already had. We did have discussion in developing the VIN 3 as far as, what terms to take as so-called primitives, which terms don't get defined and which terms do get defined. And there was debate about whether to define property, for instance, but it was decided to treat it as a primitive. But there is talk of now, down the road, maybe in the future, to back up a step, which I think is more or less what you're alluding to, and develop a definition of property and to generalize and make things a little bit more general. So that is some feedback, in fact, that we've already had. And, I would be very interested in your more extended thoughts about that.
Okay, we're going to stick offline then.
Thanks.
I think, that's emphasizing the ontology, the technology of ontology, perhaps feeding back into the standardization process to mutual benefit, which is kind of, I think, Peter, the line of your question, Ian.
Yes. Thank you very much, Chuck, for the presentation and for being here. This is very encouraging. And as stated in the communique from the Ontology Summit 2009, there is an ulterior motive for what we are doing, and that, for some of us, is that we would help drive ontology-based standards that can coexist with natural language standards, so that standards becomes interpretable both by machines, by humans, and by machines. So is Vim 3, I mean, is this the right time to bring it up for the Vim working group's consideration, and how can we best approach something like this in sort of established institutions such as the Vim?
Yeah, thank you for that comment. And yeah, I'd say yes, the time is right. I can't say for sure how well the communication will go, and you know whether the Vim committee will be able to provide any assistance to you for your machine language. I don't know much about that really, and Steve's tried to fill me in a little bit. I'm not sure how much I've absorbed, but I'd say yes, the time is right, and it's certainly something that we can keep in mind as we move forward. I guess a naive thing I could say is that it would help the machine, the modeling, the coding, whatever you refer to it as. If there is one concept, one term, I suppose that helps machines understand things better. Anyway, bottom line, yes, I'd say that whatever information you can provide that we as metrologists can relate to and understand, that would be helpful.
Thank you, and that is most encouraging.
Okay, thank you, Chuck. I think that's really good and helpful, and in fact, it's taking us further forward than we even expected to be in terms of the interaction with the metrology community. I think there's a lot to learn from both sides, and the result could be mutually beneficial and provide something that's useful for a wide range of activities.
Yes, I agree. So thank you for that.
Okay, so let us move on then to the third item on the agenda, where I'm going to invite Ed Barkmeyer to run through this set of slides talking about the scope of the ontology. Ed, over to you. Just while you're unmuting, remind everybody, if you go to the top of the page, you'll find a hyperlink to Ed's slides, and you'll be able to view them as you go through. Ed.
Many of you have probably heard this before. There's not going to be anything new for those of you who haven't. Basically, this is a reduction of a presentation I gave to the OMG a couple of weeks ago. Well, actually, no, it's a month ago or so. But this is really a set of bullets that summarizes the contents of the scope section and some other sections of the TC Charter. If you go to slide two, we had previously agreed that the following things are absolutely in scope. If we don't do these, we have not done our job. And being very careful, these might seem, excessively simple, but in fact, you can see each of them as its own sub-bullets and so on. The quantities is the general Vim concept of quantity and the subdivisions thereof, and that leads us into the notion of systems of quantities, which is base and derived quantities, and the notion dimension, and we're going to have to dance with that one as we go. And then you come to the idea of measurement units, which arise from understanding base and derived quantities, and that leads to systems of units and the base and derived units concepts and the notion of unit derivation. All of these bits are, and of course the unit derivation goes into certain parts of the algebra and so on. So all of these are parts of the thing that we know we have to have. And one of the things we agreed is that you have to have an ontological version of the SI system. That is, you have the part that says the meter is, right? And of course it says the thing called the meter is a measurement unit and it belongs to this system and so on. All right, so that's the idea. And so that has SI base quantities and units and the metric prefixes. Notice we stopped there. The derived units is coming. The notion base and derived units, by the way, is the concept base unit and derived unit. It's not which ones they are. Okay, and so now what you have here is the SI-based quantities and units are the quantities and units themselves, that is length and meter and mass and kilogram and so on. And so, but with respect to this, you can see that there's no thing here that says in that area we absolutely have to have the derived ones because, of course, there's a very, very large number of derived ones. We also have to have the concept quantity scales, which has already become an issue in the emails. This is one of the notions that is critical to understanding measures. And then we have what we call the extended scope, which is the set of things for which we really would like to have the ontology include, but which will depend on how many resources we have and how much agreement we have and how far we want to take that. One of those areas is the notion of what other explicit units get added. There are a lot of other units in common use that are metric units that are not base units, and like liter. And so you really want to obviously include some of them in the list and have their definitions in there. The question is where you stop. Similarly, we certainly need to deal with the concept of an extension mechanism for the ontology, that is an explanation of how you do document individual derived quantities or individual derived units, because the ones that we don't supply are going to have to be supplied by people who need them in their own ontologies, and as long as they're done according to a pattern, people can recognize when they are the same as somebody else's unit that has the same name and has the same derivation. If the patterns are not consistent, then you can't necessarily determine that this is the same thing that somebody else shows. So another area that is clearly going to be made necessary by the annoying behavior of the United States is the handling of non-SI systems of units. And there are other non-SI systems that are in use besides English measure, but certainly we will have to deal with a certain number of English measure units because they are in common use. For example, one of the most annoying aspects, if you like, is that the International Air Traffic Association measures altitude in feet, and always has. That leads to the next thing, which we're going to need to address, and which is much more complex, and that's the notion of unit conversion. That exists within the metric system as well, but it's well defined within the metric system. The problem, obviously, when you start dealing with systems that are not SI, is that you start having issues of exactly what fractions you have to be able to maintain and so on. And there's many other weird relationships there about how if you have a different system of units and chose a different base scheme, you can get some very weird relationships between some of the units in one system and another one. They're not necessarily simple powers. And so all of these things arise are complex things, so we're not sure about that. One of the things on the list that is sort of mentioned here that sort of didn't get mentioned is the issue of non-scalar quantities. We talked about this in the scale. It's on the list of maybes. We don't quite know what to do with that, and so we'll come back to that. We intended to make the high-level concepts general enough to support some of these, but if the concepts turned out to be too narrow, which is one of the things Pat was just saying, if the concepts turned out to be too narrow, it might end up making these things impossible to represent as quantities in our ontology, so we have to be careful about that. Finally, to make these things useful, we do need to do some work in the real area of the gum, I think, more than anything else, in talking about measurement and uncertainty and taking that part of the VIM and ontologizing some elements of that that will be needed for usages that are especially scientific measurements or engineering measurements in some cases. And at the other end of that, you have the matching set of disciplines that are also much more complex, which is specification and tolerance. And so both of those are included in the potential extended scope of work of the community, but we don't know at what point we will have the expertise and the scope limitations to tackle any of these things, and and nowhere to stop. If you look at these case lines, slide 2 and slide 3, down somewhere around about units conversion, you can see that we have a fairly large program of work if you're going to do this well and do it right. It turns out that most of the contributed ontologies actually go that far. So we at least have some base work to go from. The problem is to make it work with the standard, with the accepted standards. So that's where we are in that. We've agreed on formulation languages, and that was also covered in the charter. The reference formulation will be in CLIF. I could leave to Pat the discussion in some detail about how, what we agreed to make it possible to talk about normative formulations in OWL. If the normative formulation is in CLIF, how can you have a normative formulation in OWL? Well, notice the word derived. And that's really the view that we are taking, that there will be an axiomatic formulation in CLIF that begins by effectively defining a bunch of what would be OWL relations, that is to say, OWL predicates, if you like, so that that class becomes a thing that we can declare in CLIF. And we know that the properties of a class will be defined in CLIF, and then those will match the OWL properties of a class. And so at that point, we can say class snark, which obviously means OWL class, but it also is known exactly what the axiomatic definition of that is, which matches. And that's the intent. The consequence of that is that you can get this idea of a derived normative formulation if you just turn the CLIF elements that are so defined into the corresponding OWL elements. You get an OWL version of the same specification. However, obviously, there may be axiomatic elements in the CLIF formulation that don't have OWL equivalents. And that leads to the last bullet in the derived thing, which is that some CLIF elements might be still reformulated in OWL. What John Soa always talks about is these god-awful workarounds. Well, yeah, but some of those god-awful workarounds enable the reasoner to do useful things. So sometimes we may actually want to do that. And in that case, we would have to do the reformulation in the OWL version and then show that it's consistent with the CLIF axioms. Finally, there's for the benefit of everybody to understand these things, we want a standard notation that is the graphical notation, and we agreed to use a UML graphical notation, possibly enhanced by what is called the UML profile for ontologies that's in the ODM. There's a UML profile for OWL that basically marks up UML to say this is this OWL object and this is that OWL object. So we may be actually using that, and we probably will. And the other piece of definition that we've essentially agreed to, which probably isn't clear in the scope as stated, although it's stated, is that we really want to modularize the ontology so that users of the ontologies that we produce, or the whole ontology or parts of it, don't necessarily get a bunch of definitions they're not going to use, and in particular don't get a bunch of axioms that might conflict with certain things they really want to do that are not necessarily consistent with the entire rest of the ontology, but has to do with their particular domain. That is particularly the kind of thing that might happen if we have to stick with physical measures, and we get high-level things that are usable for the non-physical measures, but we have other things in our ontology that aren't, for example. So then they would want to avoid the axioms that don't work for the things that don't work. So that was sort of the idea, that there's a set of modules and that other ontologies can then borrow from these from the standard ontologies those pieces that are needed to their purposes and essentially ignore the others. It avoids all kinds of problems in the reasoner and other things of that sort. So that's really where we were going. And the sort of initial guess as to the, and this is, by the way, a very definitely an initial guess as to what the modules are, is that there's a quantities and units module, that is the definitions of quantity and unit and so on. There's a systems of quantities and units module. There is the derivation and dimensional algebra module. There's a conversion, a units conversion module. There's a scales module, and that might be more than one. There is an explicit SI system module, right? There is a common derived units module, which means, and then if there will be a measurement uncertainty module and a specification and tolerance module. And so that's sort of, and as I said, this is a guess. It may turn out that the actual modularity will be entirely different, but this is more or less what we expect to have as the nominal program of work on the first go. And then there's a list of reference standards that we already know about, and you can see the one at the top, which is the one that Chuck pointed you to, and the one next to that, which is the other one Chuck pointed you to, which is the International Vocabulary of Metrology and the new publication ISO IEC 80000, which is the SI systems and many related aspects of metrology standard. By the way, I'll come into this later, but one of the things that we have not discussed, because ISO 80000 does cost money, and as Pat points out, it costs many monies, but there is an issue here that ISO understands that a body that is actively developing a standard that is intended for ultimately ISO publication, that body is entitled to use ISO standards without charge for the purposes of standards development. So we might be able to get reference copies of ISO 80000 available to the working members of the committee for the purpose of alignment. And we'd have to figure out how we would do that. I know OASIS would has some arrangement, I'm sure, by which they would be doing that. For example, W3C does and OMG does, so I assume OASIS does. But these things are tricky, and one has to be very careful about the rules for how you use the documents that you get for free and so on. That's the way it works. So, but it is possible we could do that. The VIM is publicly available off of the BIPM website. Yonecki Recommendation 20, Yonecki is really UNCFAC here. The United Nations Economic Council for Europe is the home of the what we used to call EDI standards, in particular CFACT, it's basically the standards for messaging for international trade. And Recommendation 20 talks about how you cite units of measure in international trade agreements and in international trade messages. And so Yonecki Recommendation 20 is clearly a concern with respect to the ontology. The OASIS UNSML project, which we heard a presentation on a couple of months ago, is a related activity in OASIS that we have to be related to, that we will be concerned about. It's about XML representation of units of measure in publications particularly, and their reference to official standard definitions. And the HL7, the Healthcare Level 7 standards activity, has appointed another relatively well-defined publication out there called the Uniform Code for Units of Measure. Unified Code for Units of Measure. And Günter Schadhoff of that activity has been an active participant in this process, so we assume that liaison should continue. And very much, the UCUM is based on dimensional algebra, so we need to look at exactly, that will be of great assistance, but it will also be a source of some care in when we do that part. And the last bullet is, and if there's something else you know about that we should really care about, please tell us. And because we'll have to consider them when we get there. The contributed ontologies thus far are, the OWL ontologies are the three that are listed here. And you will note the names that go with them. I misspelled Hans Kato's name. sorry about that. I'll fix that, Hans Kato. I think in fact we will have some. There is some bit of that coming thus far. And the last one reads again: others as discovered. If we find another one that is a useful OWL ontology to look at, that may contribute some thoughts about how to do this, but it's certainly worth a while. And that's that. That is where we are in scope right now. There may be other documents that are contributed by the 21st of January. We don't know. And, of course, that's not a drop-dead date. Other documents can be contributed along the way as people find them and discover that they are useful. So I'm done. That was sort of quick and dirty, but I will leave it to anyone to ask questions.
Thank you very much, Ed. Given the volume of traffic on the chat board, I'm sure there will be one or two questions related to the scope of the general support for abstract quantities in there and also the mappings from Cliff to Al. Mike Bennett, if you hit star 3 and ask a question, that would be great. Mike, you there?
Oh, sorry, I unmuted myself as well. Sorry about that.
Carry on.
On the break. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up my comment in the chat thing. On the EDN Council financial industry thing, I've been effectively making up the upper ontology as I go along while keeping an eye on useful stuff to bring in later. But one thing I reworked over the last few weeks was we're looking at the issue of price, particularly prices for bonds and things, and there's two interesting things which I've separated out. Price can be expressed in multiple ways, so it can be a percentage or it can be a currency amount, or it can be a yield, for example, with reference to a reference instrument, all sorts of complicated stuff like that, which are mutable ways of expressing the same thing, which is the price. But then at another level, a price is an expression of what is essentially an economic value, but almost by definition, it never quite accurately matches that value, and of course the whole reason that prices change, the whole reason you have financial markets is the way that those change. So I've come up with the idea of a very, very general concept of a quantity, for want of a better word. I know that's an overloaded word, but something which can be expressed. And then there are added quantities. There are kinds of quantities which are kind of Platonic ideal, like value, like meaning, for example, things which you can only try and attach symbols to or try and attach values to. And then another kind of quantity is a quantity which can be expressed in various ways. And so by creating that very, very abstract model, it means that it's possible to deal with those complex issues without actually having to break something later or have incompatible ways of looking at things. So that, to me, looks like something that sits a level above a kind of physical unit of measure ontology as per most of the stuff in the scope paper. So I guess my real question is where, you know, can we conceptually define the scope of where this begins and ends so that we can see how very general concepts of expression of quantity either is or isn't part of that and where the URM ontology would then be plugged in. Does that make sense?
I was going to say, I'm going to say, as first of all, this is, you know, personal opinion rather than being the estimate of the committee, but I think there's two issues involved here, and I'm going to try to go there. The first one is that if you think about axiomatic formulation, you're saying there's a set of rules that apply to things like this, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to there may be a set of rules that we can say, all right, with respect to the concept physical quantity, which is clearly what the Vim is addressing because it says so, okay, there is a set of rules that are going to define what we mean by quantity. You could say, okay, it's a primitive term, but nonetheless there are a set of behaviors that it exhibits that are the things we want to know mean your quantity, all right? And so we can talk about those behaviors. If it turns out that, you know, physical quantities, there are seven such axioms, and physical quantities obey all seven, but there is a useful concept that obeys only five of the axioms, then we can move that up and say, okay, well, there's a concept physical quantity, which is what the Vim means, okay, and that has all these seven axioms. But there's a supertype, if you like, which is this more general concept, which is called general quantity or whatever it is, okay, that has these five axioms, and therefore, right, and your concept of quantity might obey the five axioms without the other two, okay? So I think that's one possible choice, and it certainly wouldn't hurt the ontology to do that if it were clear where that breakpoint is, if you follow me, okay?
The exact picture in my head, yeah.
Right. The second issue, on the other hand, is that very specifically with respect to the concept units of measure, the intent is that there is a fixed, reproducible reference. And one of the problems of currency is that the units of measure do not have that property, ever.
Well, exactly. And my point is that's not actually a problem. It's a difference between the kind of thing that's within, say, the Vim scope and the kind of thing that's in the wider scope of things that have units.
I guess the concern that I have is only that in that case, I mean, it might be possible to have some other thing called quantitative unit or whatever, but the concept measurement unit has got to be the thing that is reproducible, because otherwise we will, in fact, confuse a lot of very, very important usages. That's the sort of thing on which we have to be very careful about the alignment of the tail, I should think. But I mean, that doesn't prevent the idea that there is some sort of quantitative unit that is a higher level class. Again, that, you know, so all of these ideas exist. The other piece that I would be concerned about, however, and I'm going to say that I can't speak for the committee at all. Indeed, I can't speak even for NIST. I think that I particularly would not like to see the committee get terribly, terribly worried about being able to get vast generalizations of these notions to work. Okay? If we do the ones we understand and get physical quantities to work, we will be well ahead of where we would have been otherwise. And if someone can, in a later time, improve on this, that's fine, too. But I have to say, this is the gospel according to Barkmeyer and not generally.
This is why I asked the question, because I need to know whether I should care about the units of measure ontology myself or not.
I understand completely.
It sounds to me as though there may be some analogy here in the comparing absolute values with measurements for measured units, although perhaps the financial instruments may have slightly larger variations in there. One to bear in mind, Mike. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
If we can generalize and support it, that's kind of a bonus. Hans-Peter, you had a clarification in the chat room concerning the definition of metric. Well, we've had another question.
Just a small remark on slide 2, where you have metric prefixes, which more precisely should be called decimal multiples and submultiples and binary multiples. That's just a small...
Being careful, Hans-Peter, I generally agree with that view, but there is the issue, the issue here is specifically is, multiples is not the problem. The particular difficulty here is whether the metric prefixes, one is going to have some behavior of constructing terms and how that relates. And I've run into this before that I don't know how else to describe it. The issue here is that one possibility in defining the SI system of units is simply that we define the concept gram and the concept kilogram and the concept microgram and the concept milligram and so on, right? And the other possibility, and similarly we also do this for, for every other unit and then for all the derived units and so on, right? And the other possibility is that you define some means of constructing terms in which you explain how micro, what is meant by attaching the prefix micro to a term. Okay, and I don't know how we would deal with that. It's only that is an issue that is going to be raised. We've seen it in other standards, so we know it's a problem, and that's all I can say. If you follow me, that's what I understand the problem to be there.
Yeah, I do for you. I implicitly assume that we go for the second one where we have a construction capability.
Yeah, and I don't know that we will. I mean, that's the issue, but that's why I was worried. And obviously, I mean, in some sense, yes, I mean, you have the issue about whether there are other prefixes, if you like, to represent other numbers, maybe. I mean, that's just, the generalization in some sense of the idea. The question is really whether, but you're right, I mean, there is a distinction here between saying a kilogram is, it's easy to say, a kilogram is exactly 1,000 grams, if you like, or I think more accurately works the other way, but that's okay. The issue is how you handle this in the ontology and what assumptions you want to make about the numerical operations that are understood by reasoners is another issue. I don't know how close we want to go to that. That's a whole different problem. But as you probably know, I mean, OWL-V2 added a great deal of capability to talking about things that have numbers in them. Okay, that OWL-V1 did not have. So we do need to think about things like that when we build the ontology. Is that fair?
Fine. My second thing was, do we target OWL-V2 or do we not specify them on a very DL or school?
I think we, that's probably my error. I think the agreement really is that we meant LV2DL. Because, I mean, we could talk about owl full. I think the intent was to talk about LV2DL so as to satisfy that set of persons for whom the concept reasoner means tableau reasoner.
That was my understanding as well, yes.
Okay, great.
Noting that we've probably got about another half hour to run, Ravi Sharma has a question.
Ravi, please unmute.
Yes, can you hear me, please?
Yes, yes.
Can I be heard now?
Yes, yes, you're fine. Carry on.
Oh, thank you. Ed, especially for Ed, my questions are, first is that we all know that at a given time there is a standard by which we measure frequency, time or distance and things of that sort, a very basic unit. So would there be an ontology that we say, I understand the source, at a given time there is generally one accepted source, say by physicists, helium atom or something like that. So would there be always an ontology that would reason and say that's the basic unit and all others are derived units and these are the algorithms or formula you use if you want to get to decimal accuracy in this sense or something like that?
I think that's a technical content issue, Ravi. I think, you know, the exact way in which that will be handled, the ontology, is going to have to be decided by the committee. That's something we need to talk about.
But the message I take out of that is there may well be an issue of the effectivity, as we say in the aerospace industry, of the terms. Time for which the definitions are valid.
Certainly that's true. Yes.
When new research happens and suppose cesium gets replaced by another element or if they find that laser is a better way to measure frequency rather than the atomic transition. But at a given time there will be one gold or master standard, right?
Yeah. So we need to know what that time was and when was this measurement taken against it. Okay, good point. We'll call that for consideration.
Yeah, please.
And Tom Russ is also has a hand up, Tom. Feel free to unmute.
I haven't finished yet.
Oh, sorry, Ravi. Carry on.
Yes.
Carry on, Ravi.
Yes, I know it's a question of technical standards, but what I'm saying is having a short basic standard, who would develop the ontology of how it relates to other practical measurable standards, like a meter stick, for example, which then becomes a standard later measures or units of commerce-related units.
That's exactly the mise en pratique problem, right? I mean, that's the mise en pratique problem. And I'm not sure when we... I think, Robbie, the problem I'm having with this is simply that we are now... Once you go into that level, we are down... We've come down from... we're really down into those elements of the exactness of measurement and exactly what reference are you using and what practice did you use to make the measurement and so on. And I at least my problem with this is that I'm sure hoping that we will get there. And certainly all of those issues need to be raised when we come into that level of thing. That's also why it's down on my list of things we hope we get to. I'd really hope that the initial ontology will not get us so deeply into the question of exactly what the referent measurement unit realizations are. And if we do, they will still effectively be primitive. That is, we're not going to write an ontology that explains how you measure the frequency of a cesium atom. Okay.
The reason I'm asking is that on your last slide, you were mentioning some cutting-edge organizations that have very difficult missions, such as left the planet, we travel and things of that sort. The cumulative effects of some of the accuracy of street ontology might be very relevant or something of that sort. So the second question for you was, at a given time, suppose we don't get that deep and we just stay at a practical level of whatever ISO and others define, then who is going to maintain that relationship ontology among different standards?
The maintenance of the OASIS ontology will fall upon the members of the OASIS group in liaison with the relevant organizations.
But how will that relate to the UN, non-UN bodies that participate in developing relationships among standards?
Well, that has to be, as with all of these activities, the people who are interested. There's no magic source here.
So since you're talking of developing ontologies that relate multiple units of measurement, I thought that this forum would at least provide some pointers to where we see the roadmap going as to, I'm not saying vote on it, the organization, but there have to emerge some lead organizations that will say we will maintain a relationship ontology among these standards bodies.
Okay, but Robbie, I mean, that is way out of the scope of an organization whose job is to build one ontology or one set of interrelated ontologies. I mean, you know, this is, you know, you're talking about a standards management problem that is well beyond the issue of a single standard or single TC here. And moreover, I think you're really talking at the level you were trying to describe here about the kind of coordination activity that the JCGM itself is trying to do. Okay. So, I mean, that's, you know, we are in that sense, you know, the helpless pieces in the game he plays. I mean, we are a very, very small part of that problem.
This is a potential future issue because there are mechanisms for handling it. The RFID people have got the GRIFS project, the business standards have an MOU management group. But, we need to consider how this needs to be maintained, and it's the same as really any other standard activity. Okay, Eric, thanks for that. I'd like to move on to Tom Ross now, so over to Tom.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. First, let me apologize if this ends up being a question that's already been kind of dealt with, but the discussion of the extensibility of units had me thinking about the need to make sure that when you're actually expressing units, that arbitrary combinations are something that's expressible. It seems that does come up a lot in engineering calculations, where you'll take certain quantities and manipulate them and then end up with some expression that doesn't match any predefined derived unit. So is that something that's considered in scope for representing?
It certainly seems to be under the extensibility element that we were looking at. I think, Ed, if you can confirm that?
I think that, I mean, if, for example, I mean, you run into, you know, the standard behavior of measuring velocity. You're going to measure it in meters per second. It doesn't have a name. Right? I mean, that's its name, okay? And there are other units, and there are many, many such derived units that are commonly used. And it particularly relates to the phenomenon of, the trick here is that there is a derived quantity, which is velocity, and does have a name, okay? But the derived unit for it is actually, only has its characterization. Right, and so I think we should have. I agree. I mean, I think we have to deal with that. Yes.
Right. Well, there'll also be derived measures that, unlike velocity, probably won't have a name necessarily. Things like, say, kilograms per square meter. But it does sound like that is something that is under consideration, right?
Somehow, I mean, I think I certainly believe that's its scope. and will and that should be discussed about effectively. It's the sort of thing of direct references to its definition, right? It's the in one of the ISO, I think 1087-1, it talks about a term which is in effect simply the definition itself.
Okay.
And that's what we're talking about here. In effect, you're talking about the derivation formulation being used as the term.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Right, let's now plow on to the technical discussions. And I think we have a number of slides here from Pat and also from Chip on the technical issues prepared. I'm looking at your slides, Pat, the first one, thank you, which is always a good sign. Would you like to talk us briefly through the material?
Yeah, sorry about that. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I mean, really fine, and you got three slides, first one blank, yes?
Yes, yes, that's right. Move quickly to slide two. So I should say right up front that I for a series of extended reasons which we've been concerned with, I've not been able to get down to working on this work seriously until like about a few days ago. So this is very much the beginning. And what you see in front of you is a sort of my attempt to get basically starting the basic the initial processes of being clear in my own head. And putting them into common logic, into CLIP form. So this is also to some extent a kind of introduction to some of the things that we do. So you notice I tweak the definition of quantity slightly to allow it to be a property of a location. I've been concerned for a while about the BIM definition because we have things like temperature gradients, temperature at time for changing temperatures. These are sort of properties of all things that mathematically have to be produced points in space or points in a medium. And I'm not sure if they count as phenomena or not. So I thought I'd be explicit about that. So the kind of things one would say is, so there's going to be a primitive predicate, a class. Classes turn out to be predicates in just called quantity, and you assert something a quantity by saying quantity of it, the length of the quantity. These lengths will be used. The way they'll be used in CLIF is they'll be used as functions from physical entities to quantity values. So you can say length of a thing by writing open paren length close thing name close paren. So. And then that is an actual quantity value of the quantity length, i.e. an actual length. And these being functions, they have domains. And I mentioned one here, they call spatial path. That actually should be italicized because that's an example of a kind of place where I think the ontology will have a term which it will treat, the ontology formally will treat as a primitive, but will have a gloss in English attached to it or in some suitable language, natural language, that explains it. I mean, I don't want to try and get into an accent-making three-dimensional geometry. I think we just take the notion of a finite spatial path, a path in three-dimensional space with endpoints or something like that, as something that's explained. Similarly, integer and so forth, real number are going to be used. I'm going to feel free to use it in the ontology without needing to explain in ontological terms what they mean, but rely on an external understanding of some common mathematical concepts. You notice that I inserted subclass here as a relation. That's an example of the use of Hamilton terminology with CLIF. And if you look over the box on the right, which is the actual axiom, there is actually a definition of subclass there. The second axiom defines the subclass. So the X is subclass of Y when everything that X applies to, Y also applies to. And you can think of that in the body of that, that if X is V and Y is V, I interpret them there. The X and V means V is in the flat X, and again, that's the way of working with that memory. The first axiom has a strange look to it. This is how a technical thing about common logic is that every name can be used as a function or as a relation in any with any number of arguments. You have total freedom, and they're always understood as tokens. So what do you mean then to say that a function has a domain? Normally, one thinks of that the domain is the class thing on which the function is defined. I want to simply assert domains and statements about domains in English and Roman. If one wants to put logic itself to do people, simply programming that kind of logic, as it should, then you can use a trick like this first axiom, which you look at some detail. This is just sort of, basically, instead of saying the function applies only to things in its domain, what you say is, which is simply false in logic, because every function applies to everything. What you can say is, if you apply it to anything outside the domain, then the result is classified as an error.
Right.
And this is a way in which you can simulate error checks and abilities within the logic. Are you still there? I had a lag noise on the line. Hello? Okay, good. So I just put that in there as a sort of placeholder and an illustration for the ways in which this issue of whether functions have a main scale. So these are some of the sort of technical tricks you could do in a lot of things. So I had to introduce, now if you have, if quantity is applied to things, objects, materials, locations, whatever, phenomena, one needs a name for that set of things that it applies to, and I just introduced physical entity, and I'm not going to ever attempt to define physical entity, and no one should try, but it's anything to have a quality. Now, there's an important point here that there's quite a lot of intelligence that are being used actively in the real wide world, especially in biological applications, require this category of physical entities. In fact, they don't have that category. They have two separate categories, basically entities that are considered to endure through time, and those are considered to happen as time goes by. And one puts temporal parameters on these things in two different ways. And a great deal of ontological energy has been expended on this issue. So we're going to meet this when, or other people who try and use our ontology in the wider world are going to meet this. So what I've done here is just put a few notes down concerning the ways in which Cliff doesn't care, because Cliff can actually write things in both ways, and can even, and there's a general axiom written in here at the bottom, can state an equation that allows you to convert back and forth between the two different ways of writing things. Basically, you attach a temporal parameter to the object whose quality is being measured, do you attach it to the quantity function itself of an argument? So if you say the temperature of my finger at a time, or do you say, no, temperature applies to things in the world, so I'm talking about the temperature of this thing, which is a temporal slice of my finger. Now, if you find your brain going soft at this point, don't worry about it. I agree. I just mentioned it as an issue that's going to come up, therefore we can address it as a clear ontology. It's a good example of something. In OWL, one would have to take great care about that distinction, because they would appear in OWL in different ways. Okay, next slide. So I decided to try and formalize these. At the very, very beginning of our work, this was an issue on the email thread, this is characterizing different kinds of scales. The reason for focusing on this now, because it seems like a side issue, is that I looking at the VIM and some of the issues that I know were in surrounding discussion of the VIM, there's clearly an issue which is important in thinking there, which is whether or not a quantity as such, a real physical thing in the world, exists, or whether it can only be spoken of through the ability to measure it, which I think is very technological and sort of methodological way of thinking about the world. Maybe we know way out and looking there if we can measure it correctly. I think that our ontology is going to have to deal with the question of, you know, it's going to have to assume that quantities are real things. But on the other hand, there is this issue that measurements of quantities almost always come with an error of the, or an estimate or a probability distribution or whatever. They're never exactly precise. So I wanted to make our ontology, wanted to make a distinction between quantities themselves and measurements of quantities. So I got involved in the question of structuring the scales to describe measurements. And this is as far as I've got with it. As you see, perhaps you, I don't know, but probably given the pressure of time, I shouldn't go into this in too much detail. However, the reference I put on there about levels of measurement, which I took the terminology from, is a work by a psychologist, basically. So these distinctions evolve or have a great deal of importance in a non-physical or semi-physical domain that still applies. If you look at the axioms, everything in italics is something that I'm going to assume as given, as it were. I'm going to try and find ontology with class of non-negative reals or real intervals, or just a function of two members to one. I'm going to take those as given and use them. I think we can't do it, obviously, like strengths. You'll notice at the top a sort of basic bunch of assertions that the ontology would make about a scale. You can characterize the kind of scale it is, and almost all the visible ones are normal scales. I think all of them, actually. They all have absolute reruns, which is what we have there. There's a statement about the second equation that specifies what the tokens are. Using them to be numbers. So there are cases where it could be just integers, or it could be arbitrary labels of some kind or other, or things like vectors. And then you state what it is, what quantity it is that the scale measures, feature of the measure. The rest of it is it's a bunch of straightforward axioms or classic things. Which again, I don't think I should go into here in detail because that's boring stuff that we've already done. I mean, it's just a sample of all the kind of ways in which things could be expressed in some level. As you can see, some of them turn out to be straightforward. Given the definition of subclass on the previous slide, they can be simply statements of class relationships using subclass. This is just a very minor but a kind of an illuminating illustration of the way in which our terminology find it and then simply use in a way that's pretty consistent with OWL. If you've seen OWL, you've probably seen OWL XML, one of the XML-based notations, but these bracketed expressions are very similar to a widely used high-level language for OWL style, which is known as the Manchester syntax. In fact, I will be actually using those Manchester syntax-based terms in which they're directed. Okay, I think that probably answered questions. I could stop here because I know it's pressing.
Thanks, Pat. What you're highlighting here is essentially a set of axioms which people can confirm their agreement with. Hopefully the conversion to Cliff is relatively painless based on that, but the challenge is to make sure the axioms are correct.
Right. Don't get me wrong. A lot of this cannot be converted to Cliff. It's more that one could convert to OWL. It's more that the one can find the parts of it that are kind of directly transferable to OWL, and then there the Cliff also contains their definitions. But it also contains things like for example, the third X and fourth, I guess, in there, that ordinal scale is that the roar that is on the scale is reflected as a true reflection of a physical point. That statement is isn't directly translated out. It's actually How is this reflecting?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
fine.
That's
going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, first question from Chip Masters. Chip, if you could star 3 and come on.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, Pat. Could you go back to the first slide? You had a quick question about the treatment of quantity as a function. So when I see the line where you have the length of across my table is 3.25 meters.
Yes.
So when the 3.25 meters is the quantity value, the across my table is the physical entity, and length is measuring the physical entity.
That's right.
How would you handle then different units? Because for length to be a function, the range has to allow for an expression in feet as well. That would be
that's fine. Yeah, you could write an equation like equals meter, and I don't remember the word vector, but 3.25, let's say.
Right.
And then foot, whatever 3.25 meters is in feet, like that number, and you've established
right.
an entity between the lengths expressed in this way. So you have multiple terms to form meter number, foot number.
But as a function, then, so then if the range of length is, it's kind of quantity value.
The range of length is, how can I describe it? Physical length, or actual length in space. The distance from here to there. And, or the length of the line wrapped around this comfort, this cylinder, that thing. Which are conceptualized as existing prior to any way of describing them using units. They're conceptualized as real physical entities from that, although
sure.
physical is a bit shaky there. Real entities. And then there are how they can be described using various scales. And that's done using a scale name feature. I can tell the function from scale values to those same lengths.
Sure. Okay. So, hold on a second. How would be what would be the notation if I did not want to specify a particular scale?
Good question.
So
I don't know how to refer to a length without using a scale, actually. How do I do it? Other than, if you're a friend of me, I can actually sort of hold a piece of string and say this long. But
right.
but other than that, kind of a demonstrative use of conveying of a length. The only way I know is to communicate one is by using a scale and a number. If there is one, we can certainly use it in the ontology, extra. I don't have any.
Yeah, if I were doing this in Scikit-L, I would have created, quantities as functions denoting functions, and when you apply it, say, length to the length of my table, what you get is a function from scale to value. For
that
example.
Would be one way to do it. You could do that. I guess I wanted to sort of keep, and I probably am meant to. In the back of my mind, I'm probably thinking ahead to modularization. I want you to keep statements about quantities on the one hand, and statements about involving numbers and measuring scales on the other, as sort of separable. But yeah, you could do it that way.
I think that's an interesting point because we need to make sure that we end up with a set of results that people are generally acceptable with, irrespective of modelling style. So I think we'll have a few of these debates as we go through. Could I just insert a process check? We've still got a bit more to go, and I think this is all being quite useful. If we go on for about another half hour, who are we going to lose?
needs to go pretty soon.
Okay, Chuck, well, thank you for your participation. Would it be okay if we carry on for about another, well, ideally about 20 minutes?
Sure.
I'm not sure, I'm sorry to interfere with protocol here. Could I make one comment?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. This presentation just reminded me of one thing I should have mentioned earlier concerning the VIM-3, and that's care taken to try to avoid circularity in definitions.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that does need to carefully be considered here. Like, for instance, what made me think of that here was in the definition of quantity, it's got measured. And then if you go to the definition of measurement, at least in the VIM-3, it refers to quantity. And it's very difficult to avoid circularity, but I think it's very important. And so so that is one aspect of the VIM-3. I believe we were able to avoid that. And I think it was just a point that I wanted to raise. So with that I'll say goodbye and thank you very much for the hospitality.
Chad, we're really grateful to you for coming in and sharing your knowledge, and hope that you'll be able to keep us on the straight and narrow, and a real debate here that you've already had in other forums.
Okay, I'll do what I can. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Okay, coming back into the queue, Hans Peter, I think, is next.
Hans Peter, start off. Okay, this is Hans Peter, yeah. I have one on the third slide related to scale one comment, and that is to be very precise in what we mean by vector, because there are two different concepts of vector that we need to take into account. One is related to free factor and the difference between free factors and forces, where a free factor is defined in a space where basically there is no fixed reference, and forces are defined in the fine spaces where there are fixed references, for instance, thermodynamic temperature scale, the Kelvin scale has a fixed to zero, absolute zero temperature point, for instance, something like current or does not have this kind of absolute fixation. The other kind of vector is, of course, something that has magnitude and direction in terms of the 3D space.
That was definitely the sense I had in mind. I actually wasn't even aware of the usage of vector in your first terms.
There is a distinction between the two, and scale is very important to make the distinction between. You have basically two kinds of scale. The very simple scale is just defined by a unit, which gives the how to interpret the distance between two numerals which are one apart, basically, because that's of course the definition of unit. The number one on a certain scale.
Yeah.
The distance between two points that differ by one. And the more, let's say, a scale that defines a torso does have fixed points with specific semantics. So, for instance, on the temperature scale, but also, for instance, on position, where the position zero is in the origin of a coordinate system, and there are all sorts of additional properties or additional operations you can do with forces and how you can convert from vectors to forces. And the second factor, which is more what is used in engineering and so on, is where you have in 3D space three components of a Cartesian vector, or if you go more to higher tensors, in the rank 2 tensor, you get a matrix or a higher order of tensor, which is the generalization of vectors. I think the second part, where the general rate or the multiple component quantities for a mathematical space with n bases, that is something that can be treated orthogonal to the ontology we are now doing. If we restrict ourselves to just scalar quantities, then we can have an additional set of entities, ontological entities, that can be used to define factor or higher order tensor quantities. I have an example of how to do that, and that can be treated as an additional module, let's say, in X terminology. So we don't need to do that right away. We can just restrict ourselves to scalar quantities for the time being, and then extend it to vector higher order tensor quantities.
What I thought was important was to define the concepts at this level of generality so that we didn't exclude that possible extension. In other words, that I didn't want to define the only possible scales to be those that were linearly ordered, for example. And simply as I David in email, I'm sure that he's been sent publicly down, raised your presence. One of the two separate issues to do with scales of the survey and how you order them, and so forth. This stuff about scales is my attempt to lay down a useful categorization of kinds of scale, which gets us fairly quickly to the ones to the scales that are used throughout the SI system and so forth, which is absolute zero and ratios of prime and additions of prime, and they always use numbers and so forth, and there's an assumption of continuity for them. But without excluding, so not attempting to do an absolutely completely thorough economy of all possible scales, but then at the same time to relieve sort of slots that we could revisit and would enable us to have vector value in that sense, your second sense, that scales in the system. I don't know whether, it might very well be, there might be very well be a better way of doing it.
Okay, quick one for you, Ed, please. About what?
I forgot to push the button, sorry about that. I put my thing in, I should have pulled my hand down. I've put it into the side. This is a technical issue that we can discuss. I mean, I think there is going to be a whole way. What I see in this cliff thing is causing me some very strong concerns about the representation of what a meter really is going to be in that reference. I mean, if meter is a function, which is what it appears to be, then clearly I must be what it is. If meter is a function, then it means that the units of measure will end up being functions in cliffs, and I have to think about that.
let me put you straight. In cliffs, everything is a function.
Of course, it's
everything
true.
And everything is also a relation, and everything is also an individual. So it's fine. It can. But what I should perhaps have said is I'm really using the function in this way. That's not a classification of it as being a kind of an entity that can be used some other way as well. That's one of the great powers of it, that lets you be flexible.
In effect, you're saying it's a syntactic concept at this point that it has properties in the interpretation. Yeah.
That way of using it as a function is syntactic, yes.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Can we move on to your presentation material, please? You should have slides up on the top if people can download those.
I don't have them.
Yep. We can hear you, but speaking up would be better, but we can just about hear you.
Okay.
You're very faint.
Okay, let me see if I can fix that real quick. Are
you okay now?
Oh. I'm okay now?
Yep.
Okay. Let's keep playing out. Well, I only have a few things to point out. Basically, it's just some additional reference material that I can provide. I have not had any time to work on an OWL specification for Qormos, but it seems that this
discussions on the email threads and everything today that, you know, from my perspective, the best way to proceed is to get the cliff done and then just extract an OWL model from it and to ensure that existing ontologies like QUDT or QUDB have mappings for that. Does anyone have any objections or can we get responses?
That sounds to be eminently sensible, and I think Hans Reiter made a similar point in an earlier email.
Exactly. So, what I had done, which I can put on the website, is I have just provided a correspondence using the SCOS vocabulary between concepts in the two QUDT and QUDB ontologies, and I can make that graph available. If you could go to the next slide, number two, just I'll also point out that we're going to update the website with more thorough documentation of what we have on the QUDT ontology, and so it will. I'll send a link to that once you've uploaded it. But if you could go into the third slide now, and then these just show you generally get the format that's going to appear on the website. And if you go to the last slide, this just shows the instance data. So just generally speaking, I think that once we have an extract of the cliff ontology, I would like to be able to confirm that a lot of the instance data that we have generated through our NASA work can be translatable easily into these others, and that would kind of use that as a benchmark for determining how well the fit is.
Yeah,
so,
can I just quickly say that it's fact. What I plan to do is to take your OWL and basically transcribe it into it using this sort of
general
technique. I mean, that can be done for any OWL, any version of OWL. But I'm you know, if there's going to be any mismatch between the flip content got from your ontology and your OWL content, it will be because of the type of it.
So if that would be the case for both, like, the QUDB work and the QUDP work, you will import both of those and then try to rectify them, okay?
Well, yes, exactly. If there's a inconsistency between those, eggs that you planned some earlier, I haven't actually located them myself, then I will need to do something to solve that.
This is true. There is a, if you look back at the modularization slide that Ed, I believe, has presented, I think that a core that would factor out very cleanly into those modulars. I know that, like, with our work at QUDT, we did not focus on modeling scales in the same way that I think that the SML folks have done. And whereas we had done more in terms of modeling systems of units and quantities. So, you know, there are areas where if you take the logical union of the two, I think that pretty much covers a lot of the concepts that we wanted. Anyway, so basically that was all I had. I just wanted to, you know, show what I had available to provide as background information. So I'll leave it there. If there's any questions, I'll take those now, and I'll send an email to the interest group once the website's updated.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, Jeff. We have two other technical inputs, potentially. David Leals, you said you had a very short input to make. I hold you to that. Okay.
I've got nothing particular at the moment. I mean, I'm following behind, right after the Lord Mayor's show to supplement as needed.
Okay. And Hans-Peter, do you have any comments? No, you're back online. Sorry, you've lost your connection. Okay. Hearing none, let's move on then to the final part of the agenda. Thanks to everybody for listening, because it's an indication of the level of work that's already gone on and the continuing interest. What we need to do now to finalise this is to ensure that we know who's going to be involved. I have on the agenda, I have on the list at the moment, myself, Peter Yim, Jerry Smith, and one other representative from DISA, and I think others are signing up. Does anybody, for simplicity, can I ask those of you who are going to be involved in the Oasis TC to indicate that on the chat room or by email to Peter, ping a message saying that you're going to be involved. Are there any issues relating to membership that people want to bring up?
Howard, this is Frank.
Yeah.
So, I apparently missed it when it went by, but our Oasis primary representative has approved my membership to TC, and I think it's a matter of my just getting a login now.
Okay, so that's great. Yeah, I haven't looked at the charter, the roster today, but we will be chatting over the next week, as you've said, and that we're going to participate. But thank you, Martin, for highlighting your participation in this. Okay, if you can enter through the chat room your intentions, that would be really good, because we can then record those as we go forward. Thank you, that's two. We'll leave that list open for a few minutes to pick those up. Sorry, Hans Peter, you have a question. Star three?
Yes. I don't seem to qualify to become an individual member, and I can't get my organization in time to either to be a member of the Oasis. So I will not be able to formally join the group, I think. I can still informally provide my inputs, but I don't know how to solve this.
Okay. Have you spoken to Oasis, to Scott McGrath?
No, not yet. I will do that.
That's probably that's the best result, because they can often help to expedite such things through and to explain other participations that we can set up. But all the results of the Oasis group will be publicly available on the Oasis site, so there should be no problem in throwing those inputs in. And formally, I guess, we, wearing the Ontolog Forum hat, we need to ensure that we're happy that the results of all this work are passed over to the Oasis Committee, and we should invite the Oasis TC to enter into a liaison with the group to ensure that we get appropriate feedback of the results to date, so that there is some broader perspective. Is everybody comfortable with that? We establish a liaison. We've done the same thing actually with a couple of other Oasis TCs, even for simple feeding back into ISO, so that's quite useful. Question to Peter. Is Peter Yim, is there anything else we want to do from the point of view of establishing the TC? Have I missed anything?
No, you've covered them all. And I guess just a matter of caution on the IPR, I mean, we could formally agree here that we would transfer all work from the Ontolog community over to this foremost TC, just in case, because Ontolog already has an IPR policy that is open content, so there should not be any issue. But just in terms of the formality, let's just agree here.
I'm happy with that. As we say in the ISO suite, is there any objection to adoption by unanimous consent of that proposal? You have to hit star 3 before you object. Hearing none, let us record that as a decision of the meeting. So thank you very much. Okay, I think this has taken slightly longer than predicted, but I think it's been very useful in getting everybody up to speed. And I would anticipate meeting a good many of you in 2 weeks' time when we hold the initial meeting of the OASIS CROMOS Technical Committee. I shall be acting as convener for that meeting, which is very useful for me, because the first thing we do in the agenda is to appoint the chairman, which will not be me, so that will be quite easy, I hope. But let's see what we've achieved tonight. I think we've got a clear view of where we are on the technical committee formation process and the agenda for the meeting and what you need to do to join. I think we've thanked Chuck, and thank you, Steve, for fixing it up on providing the first real perspective into the standardizer's view of this activity, and I think that's actually come out better than we predicted, and we should be able to interact and actually provide some feedback into the development of VIM 3, which is actually one of the objectives of the original Ontology Summit activity. Looking at some of the requirements that have cropped up, we see the statement on using the terminology guidance that's used within ISO, which should help us to cover some of the multilingual aspects of this in terms of the definitions. There's the consideration of harmonization with the VIM definitions, and the consideration of how we might handle some of these abstract quantities. And watching some of the chat in the chat room, I'm increasingly convinced that the issues of measuring units physically and and measuring money physically are actually quite analogous. So it's something to take into account without... so that perhaps the ontology should not... unnecessarily prevent the sort of extension and abstractions that were discussed. Key point from Ravi, we need to know how we're going to maintain this long term, and that's something the TC will need to consider. We need to cover varying degrees of extensibility cover arbitrary combinations of units and combinations into multiple dimensions for vectors and tensors. And I think we're looking at a broad consensus that let's get the cliff right and then derive the other representations. So I think that's given us some quite good additional guidance on the requirements it needs to address. Okay, I think that's my summary. Does anybody have any further final points? I note the Peter has added to the list the points of contact for the membership issues, and we can see whether we can find ways for other people to participate if there are problems. Any further final points? If not, I'd like to formally thank all the presenters for their inputs and for their work to date. And we look forward now in 2 weeks to transitioning this to a formal standards development activity with participation from all key players and links into the international organizations. And I look forward to talking to you all at the same time next week, that time. Thank you very much for participating, and I think, Peter, you can hit the unmute button now.
Okay, thanks, and thank you very much, Howard, for running this meeting so efficiently, I guess the next time we meet will be January 21st at your FOMOS TC meeting.
As it will be for the first few minutes until we find the chairman. That's great. Thank you all very much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.